Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. Comments can be addressed to me at rhall@oregonstate.edu. Medicaid is a federal state program that provides health care to people with small budgets and little savings who have health care needs and cannot afford to pay for them. At least that's a short definition. In actual fact, many people of low to middle income need health care and cannot afford insurance. So many people go without. Although Oregon pioneered a program more than a decade ago that stretched its Medicaid dollars and covered more people by providing proven services to a large number of people and by not providing expensive but rarely needed treatments and treatments lacking a good track record. But now the state faces an economic crunch and thus needs to cut the costs of Medicaid if it is to serve the Medicaid population, because one alternative is that some needy people will no longer be served at all, or possibly the clinics that provide care will receive lower reimbursements, even lower than now. To address this problem, the transformation team was formed during the 2011 legislative session. This team was made up of legislators, business folks, and healthcare professionals. Their job was to redesign the way in which healthcare for Oregonians receiving healthcare under Medicaid is delivered on a community-by-community basis in a way that would both cut costs and deliver higher quality and more coordinated care. Such a system, if it works, might later be extended to all Oregonians. Dr. Vern Sabo, our guest in this forum, was part of the transformation team. In this program and the next, I talk with him about his profession, the transformation team, and some of his ideas about health and healthcare in Oregon. Today, my guest is Vern Sabo. He's a chiropractor, and he has a lot of other letters after his name, and I've got to ask him what all they are. Welcome, Vern.
Thank you.
The DC, I understand, Dr. Chiropractic, right?
Correct.
And so can you tell us a little bit about some other certifications, degrees?
Beyond the four-year chiropractic school, I completed a three-year course of study in neurology from Parker College of Chiropractic out of Dallas. And then following that, I did a three-year course of study in orthopedics, Los Angeles College of Chiropractic. And then following that, I did a two-year course of study in internal disorders that was co-sponsored by Western States Chiropractic College out of Portland and Logan College of Chiropractic out of St. Louis. And then lastly, I completed a three-year course of study in forensic science, which Logan College of Chiropractic was a sponsor of.
And oh, my goodness, that's amazing. And the last one is something I've done a bit with. You know, I have done skeletal work under physical anthropology at the campus, and sometimes we have cases. And sometimes they're ancient cases, and sometimes they're actually recent cases. 95% of them, mind you, turn out to be animal bone. But we have a fauna lab, too, so that takes care of that one. Well, anyway, you've done a lot of studies then. In between, have you practiced? Did you finish your first program and then practice and then go back for other educational opportunities?
Well, yes, I continue to practice. How the postdoctorate courses are set up is they're on the weekends. They're primarily didactic. And so we would go to a location, and we would meet for 6 hours of lecture, didactic, some practicum on Saturday, and 6 hours on Sunday, and that would be once a month. We would then study whatever it was, course of study it was, what topic it was, or the cervical spine or brain or whatever it was that next month, and then we would have modular exams along the way, and you'd have to carry a certain pass rate to be able to sit the board exams at the end.
Oh, very good. We were just in Bend recently, and I was remembering that before OSU had a big presence at the Bend campus, the community college, I used to do weekend courses for people there. That was always a lot of fun. Well, you've got a rich background then to be doing what you're doing, and your practice is in Albany, and you're on the health system transformation team. Do I have that right?
That's correct. And the health systems transformation team completed its work 8 weeks. We met at Willamette University, and now we're going into legislative hearings. The bill is now actually going to be in front of a joint committee at the legislature, joint meaning senators and House representatives, and we will be meeting on Wednesday nights.
And you have been meeting every week for those 8 weeks. How many of you are there on that committee?
There are 46 on the team, yeah.
Did 46 ever show up, or is it?
Oh, yes. And
oh,
there was usually
goodness.
A large gallery and media and so forth.
Oh, yes. My goodness, yeah. So were you given information that you then reacted to, or was it a free-for-all discussion or a combination thereof? What was the agenda that was set to you to accomplish?
Well, the agenda was primarily how to implement the Oregon's universal health care system, specifically utilizing Medicaid and Medicare dollars, how we could structure the limited dollars, global budgeting, and apply it to Oregon's universal health care system. And there's a number of federal waivers that are going to have to be submitted to use those dollars the way the team would like to use them. And then we talked about how to deliver that health care.
Wow. So the Medicaid and Medicare dollars, but then that covers certain populations, but not others. So did you talk at all about how the others were to be covered to make it universal? Because there are many people who have absolutely no coverage at all and don't qualify for either Medicaid or Medicare. And then there are some who are covered through employment or other ways.
Well, yes, this is hopefully a first step in the foundational work performed by the team relative to those dollars, Medicaid, Medicare, would then be the mechanisms by which we'd implement that would then carry over to all Oregonians and implementation of the healthcare system across all classes of individuals.
So can I ask you this? Was it primarily focused then on what is delivered and how it's delivered? And not really on the money part very much. Is that fair to say?
No, actually, the very first portion of the discussions, the meetings, were all about the money.
Oh, my goodness.
And how we could set up and distribute that money and how different organizations would interact and deliver the care with that limited amount of money. And then later on, we started discussing coordinated care organizations and how care would be delivered.
Wow. That's a big, big bulk of things to be covered and a small amount of time to do it in, but I suppose that added to the discipline and the attention. What was the makeup, besides yourself, of these 46 people? There were a few legislatures, were there not?
Yes, pretty much. Well, all of the Senate Health Committee members were on the team, and pretty much all of the, I think all of the House Health Committee legislators were on the team as well. And then we had CEOs and healthcare administrators, specific individuals that represented certain healthcare delivery organizations. We had the president of Oregon Health Science University on the team. That was pretty much the makeup of the team.
Some hospital representatives?
Yes, hospital representatives, yes.
Any just consumers who are not healthcare workers at all or legislators?
There was a representative of the state unions. And there may have been other individuals. I've lost track. There's just so many.
But I know that some citizens definitely attended regularly.
Yes, they were in the gallery taking notes, and they were free to, these are open public sessions, they were free to, when we went into our breakout sessions and our roundtable discussions, that they could be present and take notes and so forth.
But they didn't have a voice, is that correct? Or they didn't, there wasn't a public comment time per se during the sessions?
There was portions where Dr. Goldberg, Bruce Goldberg, opened it up to the gallery. But by and large, public testimony wasn't taken each and every meeting. We just had so much work.
Oh, I imagine. My goodness. Yeah, and they were evening sessions.
Yes, 3-hour evening sessions.
Yes. Wow. Do you think you covered things the way you wanted to? You as a group. I'm talking about the 46 U's.
Well, we did. We did. I think we did. There are some areas that I wish we could have discussed further relative to complementary and alternative healthcare providers. but we just had so much to cover in such a short period of time that hopefully those issues will come up, well, we'll bring them up during the joint committee hearings.
And you've been attending some of these hearings and going to the legislature for lots of things. Wow, and we have such a short legislative session, but it's jam-packed with various meetings. Do any other chiropractic physicians or other people in the complementary medical field, and how should I say that? How is there a comprehensive term that could include people not only like your professional background, but let's say naturopaths? Or I know that the midwifery group is quite well organized and has a very definite position on ways to improve the kind of care that they provide and to make it more cost effective for the patients. Have you had lots of other folks representing these ideas, or do you feel pretty much like you were appointed to do this and you're doing it and you're doing it thoroughly, but do you want company?
Well, yes, we have a coalition of, and the term that would encapsulate the other non-medical providers would be complementary and alternative health care providers or medical providers. And they would include chiropractic, naturopathic physicians, acupuncturists, certified holistic nutritionists, herbologists, and midwives, and those types of provider types.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors of Oriental Medicine would be another.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And to be clear, I am past president of my organization, but I am also the lobbyist now, the paid lobbyist for the Oregon Chiropractic Association.
Oh, my goodness.
I kind of fell into that by default. But
Nobody else wanted to do it?
Yeah. No, there's a long history. I won't go into it. And then the naturopathic physicians have a very good lobbyist, Phil Donovan, and the acupuncturists have Steve Cafori, who's their lobbyist. And so we get together and we talk and we exchange notes and we try to work together. To that end, I was working on a work group today on House Bill 2100 and kind of carrying the flag for three of the groups, chiropractic, naturopathic, physicians, and acupuncturists, and getting them on a very specific commission, research review commission, that's named in House Bill 2100, whose job it is to review conditions and prioritize which ones will be covered by the universal healthcare system, and then what evidence-based treatments will be covered by that system. We make darn sure that our complementary and alternative healthcare interventions, the evidence that supports those are thoroughly looked at. And if we have the goods, we have the evidence that supports that, that it's implemented and covered.
That's the process. So it sounds like a fairly logical, organized process. First determining kind of the diagnoses that are to be addressed. Am I hearing that right? That first that
conditions, yes.
The conditions.
Correct.
That would be, and someone would have to diagnose those, I presume.
Correct.
And then what kind of care could be provided? The current term is evidence-based, which means that a study has been done that shows that it's effective. Is that in a nutshell? I know that's not in detail, but is that basically the process?
That's the process, and patient safety is also part and parcel to that. It's not just enough for whatever intervention to get a certain clinical result, but is it safe?
That's an excellent point. One does wonder, considering, and I'm just thinking of a couple of people I know who've had very bad reactions to certain medications, certain drugs, that for them didn't turn out to be safe. May have been efficacious for some people, but not for everybody. Does it extend even to the pharmaceuticals that are prescribed?
Very much so, and you're touching upon a very key element that we view, CAM providers view, as far as true healthcare reform. We need to not only get away from the crisis intervention, but we, when it comes to the medical model of healthcare and its over-reliance on pharmacology drugs, to get true healthcare reform and to improve the health of our population, which is part of the triple aim the governor refers to, is we have to make some kind of movement away from this over-reliance on pharmacology. To put it in perspective, there's nearly right at 4 billion, that's B, as in billion prescription purchases every year in this country, 4 billion.
4 billion, my goodness.
Which result in right at 2.2 to 2.3 million adverse adverse drug events every year. Now, an adverse drug event is when the supposed drug is prescribed by the doctor, taken mm-hmm. properly by the patient, they just have an unforeseen reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those result in nearly 700,000 visits to the emergency room. That's a tremendous cost to the system,
mm-hmm.
and both in human and in financial terms. In fact, the Institutes of Medicine have shown that, and they believe this is underreported because doctors are afraid of being sued, and tort reform is a key talking point and buzzword. But nearly 100,000 Americans die every year due to adverse drug events. Now,
mm-hmm.
that's simply unforeseen. Proper drug given, taken properly, they just have a bad reaction and expire. They die. And so if you add that to medication errors, wrong medication, wrong combination of medications, or too strong a dosage, it's over another 100,000. Just when we're talking about prescription medications, again, the over-reliance, this is patient safety, improving the health of our defined population. If you combine just those two, to put it in perspective, because the numbers are so large that it's hard to get our brains wrapped around it. Just those mortality due to prescription medications in this country, to put your brain around it, a 747, Boeing 747D carries 624 passengers maximum.
Mm-hmm.
It would be the equivalent of one of those 747 jets crashing every single day, plus 220 people every day. Now, how long do you think it would be before the FAA would ground those 747s?
Right.
Not very long. So we have a problem, and that's part of healthcare reform. We've got to move away from the pharmacology, because there's many, many, many natural remedies with good evidence-based that get just as good results, if not better, without all the side effects. And so there's got to be some movement towards that and away from the standard first-line intervention by being pharmacology.
I'm tempted to tell about my most recent case that was sent to me a week ago, but I won't do that. There are just so many of them, but it ended up being a person who was given a medication that had a very bad reaction and then was given another one, which, and this is the other unbelievable part, cost over $800 a week. She had a limited insurance that paid half of it, and I haven't heard how that's working yet, but her feeling was that the physician had not prescribed that one because of the cost and had prescribed the other one because it was cheaper.
Well, here's the other thing we've talking about, Medicaid and Medicare dollars. Well, germane to that is it's the elderly patients that are primarily having a lot of the adverse events. And part and parcel to that is 83% of elderly, 65 and older, take at least one prescription medication per day. 75% take four medications per day. 11% take five prescription medications per day. And so therein lies part of the problem.
The interaction? Is that
the interactions, too high a dosage, and so forth. So,
and if I recall, generally speaking, people as they age are more sensitive to drugs and probably should have reduced doses compared to younger people. And that's, of course, a blanket statement, and I'm sure it wouldn't hold for all of them, but perhaps for some. And I remember this from some time ago, that Valium was one of those. And that has been used for a variety of things, both as a muscle relaxant and also for emotional or mental state.
You're correct. And when you speak in terms of younger people, we have 1.6 million psychiatric drugs prescribed to teenagers and children in combination. And there's no safety clinical trials that validate that giving two psychiatric drugs combined together is safe. And over 300,000, and this is probably this a little older data, but 300,000 children under the age of 10 are getting two psychiatric drugs in combination. Again, with no clinical studies showing that it's safe to combine the two psychiatric drugs.
In establishing evidence, it appears that maybe they don't look at taking two in combination, but look only at a single pharmacological product taken as directed. Am I right there?
Well, that's correct to a degree in theory, but there's also a real problem with drug research fraud. I mean, quite frankly, there's conflicts of interest. There's when we're talking about the amounts of money in pharmacology, there's a problem. For instance, Vioxx. There was a misreporting or underreporting of the cardiovascular complications of Vioxx. Celebrex, there was a underreporting of the gastrointestinal complications. Purportedly a misreport of the initial studies that purportedly showed that it protected the stomach lining, when in fact, if you looked at the entire length of the study, which was several months longer, this was published in the British Medical Journal. In fact, there wasn't any evidence that supported Celebrex protected the stomach lining at all. So, you know, how accurate those statements are, I don't know, but I've just read the reports. I believe the FDA sanctioned or fined the makers of Vioxx because of that. And there's many, many, many other instances of fines and so forth. So all of that plays into this adverse drug events and cost in human and financial terms. And that has to be part of true healthcare reform for not just the U.S., but specifically here in Oregon.
Were other people besides yourself bringing up such topics? I'm just curious.
No, I was the Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
Disturbing element, fly in the ointment, bug in the rug.
Yeah, there's something about drugs. I suppose it's part of the whole speed of moving people through the system. That's one sense that I have. When I read recently an article suggesting that psychiatry is going that way, rather than taking an hour conversation with a person, a 15-minute visit to adjust the drugs is more common mode of operation.
Well, it's also just training. Our medical colleagues, medical physicians, primarily, you know, they learn to differentially diagnose and to prescribe. Their number one tool in their toolbox is prescription medications. That's what they're trained to do. That's what they're trained to use. On particular conditions, symptomatology, you prescribe a particular drug. And if all you have in your toolbox is a hammer, it seems it's very likely everything's going to look like a nail.
What are the alternatives then? Let's talk a little bit more about them. We've already mentioned several of them. Naturopaths. What does a naturopath provide? Maybe someone comes in with pain in the stomach area or somewhere else. How would the naturopath address it?
There's a myriad of ways they address it, just much like chiropractic physicians. But let me back up. You asked initially, you said, well, What's the alternative? The alternative is wellness. The alternative is prevention. The alternative is educating, in lay terms, consumers on how to take charge to their own health and wellness, to empower them with knowledge to make positive lifestyle changes so they don't get sick in the first place. And that's what we've done as chiropractic physicians for years and years, and naturopathic physicians do as well, is to instruct in lay terms, very first little baby steps, lay individuals on how to start eating correctly, start eating nutrient-dense foods and get away from the canned and packaged sugary and salty foods, and how to start eating well, even how to cooking techniques and so forth, and very clear, understandable means, and to monitor them, to get them started and get them off stop. The same thing with exercise. It's not enough to say, you know, Joe, you need to get out there and you need to exercise more. You need to eat better. You have to instruct them in lay terms on how to do that, how to get started. And the same thing as thinking well, meditation and breathing techniques, the need to sharpen the saw, to get away in a vacation. The whole idea of prevention being to eat well, move well, think well, and the whole goal of that is to drive our patients, consumers, our defined population, towards optimal health so they are less likely to fall prey to acute and chronic illness in the first place. That's the key. Now, one of the things that I noticed in the governor's document that he sent me months ago is healthcare reform in Oregon, asking for my review as a chiropractic physician, and also the Oregon Health Authority and Health Policy Board and their subcommittee reports and so forth, is when they talk in terms of prevention, they talk about obesity. They talk about smoking cessation. They talk about alcohol and drug addiction, which are good things to prevent, to intervene on. But when they talk in terms of prevention, it's primarily screening. When they talk in terms of prevention, they're talking about screening individuals and monitoring them when they have known diseases like diabetes to make sure that they're being managed properly so they don't fall into crisis and end up in the emergency room.
Right.
Very good thing, but it's one
it's
flavor
a little
of prevention.
Late. Is that what you're
saying?
Yeah,
yeah. And then the other is to screen individuals who have whatever lifestyle for unrecognized conditions, pathology, and get them under treatment. But what we're saying is we need to back up to the front gate, very front end of it, because epigenetics, the new biology of epigenetics, means that it's been shown is that our DNA is not our destiny. You can actually, through lifestyle changes, turn off negative genes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not simply dependent on our genetic makeup. So starting in the front end, 40 to 50% of disease, of what keeps us healthy, is lifestyle changes, lifestyle choices. So we're saying, start up here. We need to really educate Oregonians on how to eat well, move well, think well, and really explain and monitor them and make sure that they make those positive lifestyle changes, driving them towards optimal health so they don't fall prey to acute and chronic illness in the first place. So that's the first thing we need to do. And these government bodies that I've been reading their paperwork, most of their prevention is relative to screening or specifically referring to obesity, specifically referring to alcohol and drug addiction. So that's something that nature chiropractic, naturopathic physicians, CAM providers, that the type of prevention we're talking about, that's what we can bring to the table. And I have been and will continue to do so until someone starts listening.
Thank you very much, Wim Sable.
Thank you.
This concludes the first part of our discussion with Vern Sable on the Health and Healthcare Forum. In this one, we discussed Vern's role as a chiropractic physician on the health system's transformation team, and we talked about the problems of the budget, and we talked about the general overuse of pharmacological treatments and some alternatives that might take the place of our conventional approach to providing health care for people. In the second half of this discussion, we'll talk more about the legislature, other alternatives that naturopathic and chiropractic physicians provide, different ways of understanding how to work healthcare, how to make healthcare, and other problems that our healthcare system currently faces. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall. It is recorded with the help of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording. Theme music is by Laurie Childers and is performed by Laurie Childers and Kent White.